just doesn't stick to a budget. Pastor Darrell felt the same way, saying that Lorraine was careless with her money because she operated under a poverty mentality. To Sammy, Pastor Darrell, and others, Lorraine was poor because she threw money away. But the reverse was more true. Lorraine threw money away because she was poor. Before she was evicted, Lorraine had $164 left over after paying the rent. She could have put some of that away, shunning cable and Walmart, if Lorraine somehow managed to save $50 a month, nearly one-third of her after-rent income. By the end of the year, she would have $600 to show for it, enough to cover a single month's rent. And that would have come at considerable sacrifice, since she would sometimes have had to forego things like hot water and clothes. Lorraine could have at least saved what she spent on cable, but to an older woman who lived in a trailer park isolated from the rest of the city, who had no car, who didn't know how to use the internet, who only sometimes had a phone, who no longer worked, and who sometimes was seized with fibromyalgia attacks and cluster migraines, cable was a valued friend. People like Lorraine lived with so many compounded limitations that it was difficult to imagine the amount of good behavior or self-control that would allow them to lift themselves out of poverty. The distance between grinding poverty and even stable poverty could be so vast that those at the bottom had little hope of climbing out even if they pinched every penny. So they chose not to. Instead, they tried to survive in color, to season the suffering with pleasure. They would get a little high or have a drink or do a bit of gambling or acquire a television. They might buy lobster on food stamps. If Lorraine spent her money unwisely, it was not because her benefits left her with so much, but because they left her with so little. She paid the price for her lobster dinner. She had to eat pantry food the rest of the month. Some days, she simply went hungry. "It was worth it. I'm satisfied with what I had," she said, "and I'm willing to eat noodles for the rest of the month because of it." Lorraine learned a long time ago not to apologize for her existence. "People will begrudge you for anything," she said. She didn't care that the checkout clerk looked at her funny. She got the same looks when she bought the $14 tart balsamic vinegar, or ribs, or on-sale steak, or chicken. Lorraine loved to cook. "I have a right to live, and I have a right to live like I want to live," she said. "People don't realize that even poor people get tired of the same old taste. Like, I literally hate hot dogs, but I was brought up on them. So you think, when I get older, I will have steak. So now I'm older, and I do." The next month was August, and Lorraine used some of her food stamps to buy instant mashed potatoes, ham, and creamed corn for a hard luck family that had moved into the trailer next to Beaker's. The family of six had recently lost many of their things in an eviction and were sleeping on the floor. Once dinner was ready, Lorraine led a prayer. "Dear God in heaven, thank you so much for this food, and thanks for all the people in my life who have blessed me. Thank you for Jamie, and thank you for my brother Beaker. Even though he makes me so angry sometimes, I still love him, Lord. Please take care of my brother. Amen." 2 days later, someone knocked on the door. It was a tall white man with a mustache and a tucked-in collared shirt. He was holding a bright yellow piece of paper. "Good morning. We're going out to shut your gas off this morning," he said. Lorraine took the paper. "Oh, okay," she said sheepishly. "There's payment information on the back there. Have a nice day." The man went behind the trailer with his toolbox. "So Uncle Beaker hasn't been paying the gas?" Jamie asked, working her mascara brush. "I guess not," Lorraine said, looking down at the yellow paper reporting a debt of $2,748.60. "When do you finally grow up and start paying your bills? Uncle Beaker needs to grow up and stop living like a child. You too, Mom. You have a real problem with living above your means. You need to really just not do that." Lorraine looked at her daughter. "I don't know when you got so cute," she said. As fall bled into winter, warmth began seeping out of the trailer. The thin walls and countertops and water and silverware in the drawer grew cold. Lorraine and Beaker burrowed under blankets, doubled up on sweaters, and plugged in two small space heaters. They both slept more to keep warm. If Lorraine fell asleep on the couch, Beaker would put an extra blanket over her. Early morning was the worst. Beaker would put on his heavy coat, but Lorraine's winter clothes were sitting in Eagle Moving's bonded storage facility. They were not the only tenants in the trailer park who couldn't afford to reinstate their gas before the first snow fell. As for Tobin, he hated the snow. He traveled to warmer climates during the winter. One fall day, Beaker told Lorraine he was moving to a federally subsidized assisted living facility for the elderly and disabled. The following morning, he did. This caught Lorraine by surprise. They never really learned to talk to each other. After Beaker left, Lorraine knew she had to come out of hiding and make new arrangements. If not with Tobin, then at least with the new management company. She worked up the courage and walked down to the office in sweatpants and a stained black fleece. "I need to get emergency assistance as soon as possible," Lorraine told the college kid who had replaced Lenny. "I'm so cold. The heat. All I know is I need the heat on." "Oh my goodness," the college kid said without looking up. He was nonplussed. He was learning. The college kid dialed the number to Beak Management and put Lorraine on the phone with Geraldine, the office manager. Geraldine told Lorraine that Beaker owed almost $1,000 in back rent. The gas bill was not the only one he hadn't paid. Lorraine sat in the office chair, resting her forehead on her palm. "Please, Geraldine, I need your help. I need your understanding." After a few more minutes, Lorraine hung up the phone. Her best hope of staying, she believed, was to convince Beaker to pay his back rent. Beaker's new place was in the Woods Apartments on College Avenue and 35th Street, across the street from Mud Lake. It was white wall clean and new-smelling and warm. Lorraine asked Beaker to settle his debt with Beak. He said he could not pay two rents. Lorraine said she couldn't pay last month's rent because her money had already gone to storage. At this point, Lorraine had paid Eagle Moving $1,000. Reuben had room to store Lorraine's things, and Lane had a truck, but both said no when Lorraine asked them for help.
"Well, I hope you go live with your storage, because that's all..."
Beaker stopped himself. Lorraine looked pitiful. She had heavy bags under her eyes, and her hair was a mess. It had been days since she last showered. She refused to ask Lane and Susan to use theirs. Beaker knew his trailer might just as well have been an abandoned shed. The heat, hot water, phone, and cable had been cut off. A helpless, dull silence hung between brother and sister. Then Beaker said,
"Take one of those sweaters."
The rain had 6 days to be out of Beaker's trailer. Beaker had written Beak Management a letter that read, "I'm moving and will be leaving my trailer to Beak Management for the money I owe them. I'll be out, and so will my sister." Lorraine learned about Beaker's betrayal, that's what it felt like anyway, when one of Beak's property managers got her on the office phone 3 days after she had visited her brother in the Woods Apartments. The manager told Lorraine to be out by the first of the month. She had pleaded,
"Please, I have no place to go." And, "I'm not this bad person."
But in the end, she just said,
"I see. I see. Thank you for your time, and God bless you."
Lorraine sat down.
"I don't know what to do or where to go anymore," she said. "I have no idea."
Lorraine began looking for a new place to live in the streets surrounding her church. It was the centerpiece of her life. It might as well be the centerpiece of her housing search, too. She shuffled gingerly along the icy sidewalks, calling landlords. Then she decided to stop by the housing projects in South Milwaukee, where she grew up. The woman in the office told Lorraine they were full and not accepting applications, but she gave Lorraine the address to HUD's offices. The Milwaukee branch of the Department of Housing and Urban Development was located downtown, on a top floor of The Blue, a grand modern tower with a mirrored facade interspersed with rows of candy blue glass. Lorraine's wet shoes squeaked on the lobby's terrazzo floors. The HUD receptionist handed Lorraine the multifamily housing inventory report, 13 legal-size pages listing all federally assisted rental housing
in the metropolitan area.
I have no idea where half of these places are, Lorraine muttered at the long list of addresses and phone numbers. It hardly mattered, since most of the properties were reserved for the physically disabled or elderly. In fact, for years, Lorraine had assumed that most public housing was exclusively for senior citizens.
And even they, a lot of them, couldn't get low-income housing, she remembered.
So I thought, if they can't, neither can I.
It was why Lorraine had never before thought to apply for public housing. Politicians had learned that their constituents hated the idea of senior housing a lot less than public housing for poor families. Grandma and Grandpa made for a much more sympathetic case, and elderly housing provided adult children with an alternative to nursing homes. When public housing construction for low-income households ceased, it continued for the aged, and high-rises originally built for families were converted for elderly use. Lorraine found two addresses on HUD's housing inventory that accepted applications for people who were neither elderly nor handicapped, and that were located on the far south side of the city. Lorraine did not consider the near south side to be an option, let alone the north side. The application asked if she had ever been evicted. Lorraine circled yes and wrote, I had some complications with the landlord, and he evicted me. On the day Lorraine had to be out of Beaker's trailer, ice spread over the city. An early December snow had fallen, melted, and when the temperature dropped, froze. Lorraine stood in her kitchen listening to the sawing sounds of people scraping their car windows and chipping the ice from their doors. There was a pile of trash on the floor, mainly Beaker's empty Maverick cigarette boxes and chocolate milk bottles, and dirty dishes were piled in the kitchen sink. The cold had immobilized Lorraine under blankets on the couch. The cold and question of what to do next. Little had been cleaned since winter had arrived.
I don't care anymore, she said, swallowing pain relievers and antidepressants.
Lorraine had applied to or called on 40 apartments. She had had no luck on the private market, and her applications to public housing were still being processed. Lorraine didn't know where she was going to go. She was considering approaching Thomas, a man her age who lived alone in the trailer park, or Miss Betty, whom Lorraine knew only as an old lady who lives across the road. Lorraine packed up her remaining things. Her plan was to pay public storage $50 to keep them. Late in the day, Lorraine knocked on Miss Betty's door. She was a small white woman with crystal eyes and silvering blonde hair falling past her shoulders in double braids. Miss Betty looked younger when seated and enjoying a slow cigarette, but she walked like an old woman, hunched with one arm held close. What the women knew of each other came from passing hellos and rumors. But when Lorraine asked Betty if she could stay with her, Betty said yes.
Sure, you can stay with me, until after the winter.
Miss Betty raised an eyebrow.
I know you're not as big of a problem as they say you are.
Lorraine smiled.
I'll be able to take a shower and everything, she said.
Betty's trailer might have been the most cluttered in the whole park. There was room for Lorraine, but little else. Miss Betty had piled her tables with magazines and old mail and canned food and bottles of soy sauce and candy. In the living room, a tree bent toward the window, shedding its leaves on the floor, and keepsakes were clustered together on shelves next to a picture of Jesus. There was an order to the mess. The bathroom drawers bore a resemblance to the nuts and bolts aisle at the hardware store, with all the travel-sized tubes of toothpaste and bobby pins and hair ties and nail clippers grouped together in their own respective compartments. In the kitchen, Betty had hung a sign. Self-control is defined as refraining from choking the shit out of someone who is desperately deserving of it. Lorraine agreed to pay Betty $100 a month. A few days after moving in with Miss Betty, Lorraine heard back on her applications to public housing, in the form of two rejection letters. Each letter listed a pair of reasons Lorraine's applications were turned away. Collections from the state of Wisconsin and eviction history. Lorraine understood eviction history, but not collections from the state of Wisconsin. When she called to find out more, she was told she owed property taxes.
Property!
She laughed after getting off the phone.
I'd love to know how I owe property taxes.
Betty thought Lorraine should appeal. She looked over the top of her large glasses and said,
"You have to fight, Lorraine. I had to fight for my Medicaid."
"I don't have the energy," Lorraine answered.
"I don't feel like getting rejected again."
Betty nodded. She understood. A few days later, found Lorraine in an especially religious mood, her church's truth class fresh in her mind.
"When you look at Jesus, what do you see?"
Lorraine asked Betty.
"A hottie,"
Betty replied without missing a beat. A long, unlit cigarette shot out of her lips like a plank from a ship.
"Oh, Betty," Lorraine giggled.
Betty sauntered over and tapped the Jesus picture.
"Hottie," she repeated. "I've always liked men with facial hair."
"Naughty Betty," Lorraine cooed. The new friends talked and laughed into the night. On the couch, they fell asleep at the same time. 19. Little. The cheapest motel Pam could find charged $50 a night. They checked in and started calling friends and relatives, hoping someone would take them in. 2 days passed without any luck, and Pam began to worry.
"Everybody we knew weren't answering our phone because they knew we needed a place to stay," she said.
Then Ned lost his part-time construction job. He was fired for the 2 days of work he missed when helping his family move from the trailer park. Job loss could lead to eviction, but the reverse was also true. An eviction not only consumed renters' time, causing them to miss work, it also weighed heavily on their minds, often triggering mistakes on the job. It overwhelmed workers with stress, leading them to act unprofessionally, and commonly resulted in their relocating farther away from their work site, increasing their likelihood of being late or missing days. Ned's firing wasn't out of the ordinary, but that was little consolation for Pam. Their money was running out. Even so, Ned refused to call his family. Typical, thought Pam. Ned called home to brag, but rarely to ask. So Pam worked her phone, calling almost everyone she knew, and even churches. Nothing. Finally, a friend agreed to take the girls until Pam and Ned got back on their feet. They dropped off the three oldest girls and kept 2-year-old Kristen with them. Then Ned's phone rang around 10 p.m. It was Travis, a buddy they used to party with in the trailer park, and who had since moved into a nearby apartment complex. Travis offered his couch. Pam breathed a sigh of relief. At least she wouldn't have to bring her new baby back to a cheap motel. Travis was their first godsend. Durkee was their second. A muscular, white-haired man with a professional-grade mechanics shop in his garage, Durkee gave Ned an off-the-books job customizing motorcycles. Ned had met him through a mechanic buddy. After a month at Travis's, Pam and Ned sensed he was about done with them. When Kristen got fussy, Travis would tighten his jaw and shut his bedroom door, and not only because he had to be up at 4:30 the next morning for work. The last time Travis let someone stay with him, it was his brother and nephew, and those two drunks got him evicted. Ned would tell Pam to hush her kid, and Pam would tell him that she was his goddamn kid, too. One morning, they drove to Durkee's garage. Kristen and her Care Bear buckled up in the back seat. Pam was due in 9 days. They were no closer to a new home than they were the day Tobin kicked them out of the trailer park. They might have to live on the near south side, with the Mexicans. Ned was out of cigarettes because Pam was smoking more to offset stress and hunger pains. Kristen was throwing a fit because her lovey Teddy got thrown in storage after the eviction. Durkee wanted Ned to do a transmission, which would probably mean working deep into the night, and he hated that his family had to rely on Travis. When he turned toward the booming music and saw a car with 2 young black men in the lane next to him, he hated them too. "Fucking niggers," Ned bit. A few minutes later, Ned spotted a rent sign in white, working-class West Allis and told Pam to write down the phone number. She missed it.
"I told you," Ned said. "I told you the fucking number, and you just can't write it down? Not when you say it so fast. I'm not the one with the fucking problem."
They circled back and got the number.
"Hi, I was calling about your place on 76th and Lincoln. What's that, a 2-bedroom?
"Yep," a man's voice said. "It's $695 a month with heat." Pam didn't hang up. Maybe he was flexible. Okay, when is it available?
Now.
It is?
Okay. And who would be living with you?
My family.
Pam paused and then decided to tell him about most of the kids.
I've got 3 children and 1 on the way, but they're all girls.
Oh, no, no, no. We're trying to keep it to all adults.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Pam brought the phone down.
They don't want kids.
Ned was wearing a black Ozzy Osbourne cut-off t-shirt and Harley Davidson cap turned backward. He whistled through his teeth.
I know. As soon as you say you've got 4 fucking kids, we're fucked.
Pam Noah didn't even take that. When house hunting a few days earlier, 2 landlords had turned her away on account of her kids. One had said,
"We're pretty strict here. We don't allow no loud nothing."
The other had told Pam it was against the law for him to put so many children in a 2-bedroom apartment, which was the most Pam and Ned could afford. When talking to landlords, Pam had begun subtracting children from her family. She was beginning to wonder what was most responsible for keeping them homeless. Her drug conviction from several years back, the fact that Ned was on the run and had no proof of income, their eviction record, their poverty, or their children. Children caused landlords headache. Fearing street violence, many parents in crime-ridden neighborhoods kept their children locked inside. Children, cooped up in small apartments, used the curtains for superhero capes, flushed toys down the toilet, and drove up the water bill. They could test positive for lead poisoning, which could bring a pricey abatement order. They could come under the supervision of Child Protective Services, whose caseworkers inspected families' apartments for unsanitary or dangerous code violations. Teenagers could attract the attention of the police. It was an old tradition, landlords barring children from their properties. In the competitive post-war housing market of the late 1940s, landlords regularly turned away families with children and evicted tenants who got pregnant. This was evident in letters mothers wrote when applying for public housing. "At present," one wrote, "I am living in an unheated attic room with a 1-year-old baby. Everywhere I go, the landlords don't want children. I also have a 10-year-old boy. I can't keep him with me because the landlady objects to children. Is there any way that you can help me to get an unfurnished room, apartment, or even an old barn? I can't go on living like this because I am on the verge of doing something desperate." Another mother wrote, "My children are now sick and losing weight. I have tried, begged, and pleaded for a place, but it's always too late or, sorry, no children." Another wrote, "The lady where I am rooming put 2 of my children out about 3 weeks ago and don't want me to let them come back. If I could get a garage, I would take it." When Congress passed the Fair Housing Act in 1968, it did not consider families with children a protected class, allowing landlords to continue openly turning them away or evicting them. Some placed costly restrictions on large families, charging children damage deposits, in addition to standard rental fees. One Washington, D.C. development required tenants with no children to put down a $150 security deposit, but charged families with children a $450 deposit plus a monthly surcharge of $50 per child. In 1980, HUD commissioned a nationwide study to assess the magnitude of the problem and found that only 1 in 4 rental units was available to families without restrictions. 8 years later, Congress finally outlawed housing discrimination against children and families, but as Pam found out, the practice remained widespread. Families with children were turned away in as many as 7 in 10 housing searches. Ned got out of the car and gave Kristen the rest of his McDonald's breakfast sandwich.
"Give Daddy a kiss. I'll be working. Love you."
He kissed Pam, too. Pam put her hand to her forehead. "I'm ready to pop."
"Mama, playground, play,"
Kristen asked from the back seat.
"No, Kristen. Mama's busy looking for a place for us to live."
"How old is the child?"
the landlord asked.
6.
"Call back next month."
Arlene hung up. She had called on or applied for 82 apartments. She had been accepted to none. Even in the inner city, most were out of her reach,
and the landlords of the places she could afford, if she handed over everything, weren't calling back. Arlene started again, dialing three more numbers. Too expensive. Automated message. Call back Monday. Arlene was exhausted from rushing to the hospital the night before. She had run out of prednisone, and Jafaris had had an asthma attack. It was hard for Arlene to stay on top of his asthma, with so many other things to worry about. Once, she ended a long and fruitless day of apartment hunting with the awful realization that she had left a backpack with Jafaris' breathing equipment at a bus stop. After a day without treatment, Jafaris seemed fine. But 2 days later, he woke up and told Arlene,
"Mommy, I don't feel good."
She heard him wheezing and called an ambulance. That time, they had transferred him to Children's Hospital near the zoo and kept him overnight. This time, they were able to make it back to the shelter by 10:30 p.m., and the on-call social worker was nice enough to pay for a cab to and from the hospital. When number 85 answered the phone, Arlene replied, "Hi, how you doing?" instead of, "Hi, how you doing?" or, "Hi, I'm calling about your property." She had been trying different pitches and bending her voice in different directions. She would tell one landlord one thing and another something else. Sometimes she was in a shelter. Sometimes she wasn't. Sometimes she had two children. Sometimes one. Sometimes they were in child care. Sometimes they weren't. Sometimes she received child support. Sometimes she didn't. She was grasping, experimenting, trying out altered stories at random. Arlene wouldn't know how to game the system if she wanted to.
"Is there a man in the picture?"
Number 85 asked.
"There won't be no man." "Are you going to have men coming over once in a while?"
"No, it's just me and my son."
"How old is your son?"
Number 86 had wanted $825 a month plus another additional $25 for jewelry. But number 88 had left her with a good feeling. Number 88 was a large three-story brick building at the end of a dead-end road on Milwaukee's north side.
"I think that at one time it was an institution," the building manager told Arlene. "Could have been an old people's house or something."
"Mental ward," Arlene guessed.
Inside was clean and quiet. The walls were not off-white or beige, but hospital white. Rich people's teeth white.
Dark wood doors with brass numbers opened into long and low-ceilinged hallways. Arlene and the boys followed the building manager and listened to the squeaks of their shoes. Behind the manager's back, Jory lunged at Jafaris, making him jump, and the boys let out a muffled laugh, which helped shake away the creeps.
"My name is Ali," the building manager said. "It means of noble descent."
A straight-backed black man with a brown kufi, Ali wore beige pants and a matching beige shirt, buttoned to the top. He showed Arlene into the first unit.
"I got one or two problem tenants," he said, "but that's it. It's just that some people, they can't get with that Huxtable culture. They more South Central in their culture, and I don't like that culture."
Arlene looked around the apartment, which was decorated with sparse furniture that probably predated the Cosby Show.
"You know," Ali continued, "doing life like you're supposed to be doing, paying your bills."
He was clearing his throat and speaking stronger now.
"In a committed relationship, that's a big one right there. I be on black women, you know, not having no committed relationships and be Ms. Independent. Let's bring back family. If you ain't trying to be about family, then I don't care about sister here and helping you in any sort of way. I'm about family, about what's right and good."
Arlene had been smiling at Ali, and he just noticed. He was funny.
You like this one, or you want to see another one?"
"Doesn't even matter. I just need a place."
The rent was $500 for a one-bedroom. The light bill would be in Arlene's name. On the application, next to previous landlord, Arlene wrote Sharina Tarver. Next to reasons for moving, she decided on slumlord. Arlene hesitated, then went ahead and asked if cats were allowed.
"They say no pets, but I myself, I do like cats. Can't stand dogs, so I might be willing to negotiate on that."
"Well, I'd appreciate it.
Arlene looked at Jory. She was mostly doing this for him. He understood that and It showed in his big brown eyes. Don't cry, Jory, because you're about to make me cry. Jory quickly turned away and walked to the window. Arlene decided to stop to see her cousin, J.P. She adored J.P., with his wide face and easy demeanor. Let's see if his landlord have anything, she said. Ali was nice, but he wasn't the one who approved applications. Arlene also wanted to check in on her son, Boosie, who had been sleeping at J.P.'s place on 26th Street in Chambers, which might have been the exact middle of the ghetto. Not long after Larry walked out, Child Protective Services removed Jer-Jer, Boosie, and Arlene's three other children from her care. I just gave up responsibility, Arlene remembered. That really, really hurted me when he did that. I wish I was stronger. In the years that followed, Arlene's children grew up in and out of foster care. But Boosie never wanted to come back home, Arlene said. She remembered Boosie calling CPS when he was 15, telling a caseworker that the children had been left alone. So they came to take my kids again. She had Jafaris by then. He was 2 at the time, and Jory was 10. Both boys would later rejoin Arlene, but Boosie and Arlene's other 2 children from Larry remained in the system. Arlene didn't know why. She did know that their foster families had more money than she did. They could buy her children new clothes, feed them every night, and provide them with their own beds to sleep in. But unlike his younger brother and sister, Boosie didn't stay in the system for long. When he was 17, he left his foster family, dropped out of high school, and started selling crack. A dark stairwell opened into the bright apartment. The house was warm and smelled of eggs and sausage. Boosie was on the couch, skinny with a backwards cap. After noticing Arlene and the boys, he grabbed a pellet gun made to look like a .45 and charged toward Jafaris. Boosie stuck the gun in Jafaris's back and tackled him onto a mattress in an adjoining bedroom, causing someone's copy of Bastard Out of Carolina, folded down to keep a place, to flop on the floor. Jafaris wiggled and laughed, but couldn't escape.
Man, have you ever seen a 6-year-old more gangster?
Boosie laughed, releasing Jafaris and handing him the gun. Jafaris smiled and inspected the piece.
Aye, little nigger, give me back my gun.
Arlene shook her head, and Boosie nodded back at his mother. Arlene asked J.P. to call his landlord, and he did. The landlord said that the downstairs unit was available. Before leaving, Arlene made an appointment to see it the next day. Boosie bogus, she vented to Jory when they got outside.
As skinny as he is, he either tweaking or they ain't feeding him.
Her face was heavy with a mother's concern. She shook it off. I can't worry about that now.
You gonna take it?
Jory asked, hopeful. Arlene considered the lower unit.
I don't know. There's too much drama over here, she said, thinking about cops and drugs.
Arlene pushed on, staying on the north side. She passed the simple blue house where her mother had died, and the apartments on Atkinson she called Crackhead City. She stopped by her old condemned house on 19th and Hampton, squat, quiet, and still half-painted. On the front door, a sign was posted. This building is illegally occupied or unfit for human habitation and shall be vacated.
God, I miss living at this house, Arlene said.
Jafaris volunteered to check the mail, and Arlene smiled at him.
We ain't got no mail, boo.
What forced her to finally call the city was not the water problem. When it didn't work, they made do, fetching gallons from a nearby store. But when the landlord finally came over with his toolbox, he sawed holes all over the bathroom walls and did something to the pipes that caused water to leak in. When Arlene called to complain, she remembered him saying, Well, I've got over 50 properties. If you can't wait, move. That's when Arlene called the building inspector.
Stupid of me.
Ned spent all day on the transmission, and Pam spent all day looking for housing. She called so many numbers that she lost track and phoned landlords who had already told her no. In the fuzz of the afternoon, she dialed the number of the West Allis landlord again.
We don't want your kids, ma'am, he said, annoyed.
Pam decided to try an apartment complex her friend told her was full of crack and hookers, figuring the landlord didn't do background checks. But the landlord wanted $895 for a 3-bedroom unit. Pam couldn't believe it. To live in this shithole? It was then that she began looking on the Hispanic South Side. She sighed. Well, I guess they don't have a choice. After calling on 38 apartments, Pam had only 2 appointments to show for it. One in Cudahy, a working-class white suburb whose western border ended at the airport, and another on the South Side. The Cudahy apartment was a 2-bedroom place on Packard Avenue. The rent was $640 with heat. Early on in her housing search, Pam had fantasized about finding something for only $500. In case me and Ned, who knows what'll happen, but that was close to impossible. Pam would rather have given a landlord everything she had than live on a block where most of her neighbors weren't white. Ned and Pam waited anxiously outside the Packard Avenue apartment. Ned told Pam to keep her mouth shut and let him do the talking. That was fine with Pam, who was due any day and just wanted to crawl into bed. "Pray and pray and pray," Pam whispered. "There ain't no need to pray because there ain't no God up there anyway," Ned said, spitting. When the landlord arrived, Ned started jawing with him. "I've been in construction for damn near 20 years. You need work doing around here?" The apartment was clean and new, with a huge bedroom in which all the girls could fit. Things seemed to be going well until the landlord asked him to fill out an application. Ned offered cash, but the landlord insisted Ned fill out the form. "Is it hard to get in?" Ned asked. "We do a credit check and stuff," the landlord said. "Well, our credit ain't the greatest." "That's okay, as long as you don't have any convictions or evictions." The second appointment was on 35th and Beecher, on a quiet street in a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood. The landlord was asking $630 for a 3-bedroom unit. "That's okay," Ned said, looking up and down the block. "I can live with the Mexicans, but not with the niggers. They're pigs." He grinned, remembering. "Hey, Pam, what's a name you never want to call a black person? I'll give you a hint. It starts with an N and ends with an R. Neighbor." Ned cackled, and Pam forced a smile. She sometimes bristled at Ned, especially when he said things like this in front of Bliss and Sandra, or told them that their curly black hair looked ugly. But it wasn't like Pam felt differently, at least as far as neighborhoods were concerned. "I would rather live in a motel room than live in the ghetto," she said. "At least at the trailer park, everybody there was pretty much white. They were trashy white, but still." There were no variations in the ghetto, as far as she was concerned. It was one big black village. The landlord arrived, a silver-haired man with a large belt buckle, and showed Pam and Ned in. The apartment was gorgeous, with polished wood floors, new windows, fresh paint, and spacious bedrooms. Pam looked out the back window to see white children playing in a well-kept backyard. The landlord even offered to throw in some appliances. Ned and Pam laughed at Belt Buckle's jokes and started ingratiating themselves to him. "I see you need some concrete work done," Ned said. "I do good work at reasonable prices." Pam joined in, saying she'd be ready in a couple weeks if he was in the market for a cleaning lady. When it was time to fill out the application, Ned took a different approach. "What's this? Credit references?" he asked. "Just leave them blank," the landlord responded. "What if we don't have a bank here? We just moved from Green Bay." "Just leave it blank, then." After waving goodbye, Pam turned to Ned. "Even if the area's a shithole, at least it's nice. A nice place. We'd be living in an upgrade of a ghetto." "Maybe I'll get a concrete job out of it?" Ned wondered. "Maybe I'll get a cleaning job out of it?" Ned lit a Marlboro Red. "It really looks like something we could get into," Pam added. Ned felt the same way. He told Pam to stop copying numbers off rent signs. "Don't worry about it, Pam. We've got a place." That evening, Travis told Ned and Pam they had to leave. They checked into a cheap motel. Sitting on a scratchy, overwashed comforter on the edge of the bed, Pam breathed slowly and talked to her baby. "Hold off.
until we sign that lease. Just hold off.
The baby didn't listen. Pam's water broke, and an older woman staying at the motel gave her, Ned, and Kristen a ride to the hospital. The baby weighed 7 pounds, 10 ounces. Ned thought she was big for a girl.
That's proof that cigarette smoking doesn't cause low birth weight.
He laughed. They stayed in the hospital for 2 nights, on doctor's orders, being charged for a motel room they were using only to hold their things. 4 days after the baby came, Beltbuckle called and told Pam and Ned that their application had been approved. Pam had 2 evictions on her record, was a convicted felon, and received welfare. Ned had an outstanding warrant, no verifiable income, and a long record that included 3 evictions, felony drug convictions, and several misdemeanors like reckless driving and carrying a concealed weapon. They had 5 daughters, but they were white. Pam would have preferred the Packard Avenue apartment. Even if it was smaller, it was in Cudahy, but that landlord had said no. Their eviction and conviction records pushed them out of white neighborhoods and into an area that families living on the north side dreamed of moving to. Ned squandered it. 3 days after moving in, he got into a drunken altercation with the upstairs neighbors. The landlord gave them a week to find a new place. That was all the time they needed. Ned found a clean 2-bedroom apartment in a working-class white area near Durkee's garage, going for $645. It had a pear tree out front. Ned applied by himself, leaving Pam and her 2 black daughters off the lease.
"People like single dads," he told Pam.
The landlord approved him. "The landlord doesn't know about me or the 2 girls? Pam asked.
"Nope, but give it some time. I had to get a house, and I got us this place in a week."
Ned raised his hands as if accepting applause.
"See? Good things happen to good people."
Soon after moving in, a neighbor hooked Ned up with a construction job, and Pam began working as a medical assistant. Ned told Bliss and Sandra to tell the landlord they didn't live there, if she ever asked. He told them a lot of things like,
"You're as stupid as your father,"
and,
"You're a half-nigger snitch."
One day he got a kick out of getting all the girls to march around the house chanting, "White power." It emptied Pam out. She prayed it wouldn't hurt the girls in the long run. She prayed for forgiveness, for being a failure of a mother. But she felt that circumstances bound her to Ned.
"This is a bad life," she told herself. "We aren't doing crack, but we are still dealing with the same fucking shit. I've never been in a position to leave."
The best she could do was to tell her girls, when they were alone, that Ned was the devil. Some nights, before she fell asleep, Pam wondered if she should take her girls to a homeless shelter or under the viaduct.
"As long as we're together and we're happy and positive things are said. And I just want to tell them that they're beautiful, because my girls are the strongest little women in the world."
Arlene tried a large apartment complex on Silver Spring Drive. Ali, number 88, never called back. She dialed the number, and the building manager agreed to show her a unit on the spot.
"We home, Jafaris,"
Jory yelled, smiling.
"Don't tell him that," Arlene said.
"This is our home, man,"
Jory joked again, elbowing his brother.
"Stop saying that."
This time, Arlene yelled it imploringly. After another showing, another application, they were back on the sidewalk.
"I'm hungry,"
Jafaris said.
"Shut up, Jafaris," Arlene snapped.
After a few minutes, Arlene dug in her pocket, found enough change, and stopped by McDonald's to buy Jafaris some fries. Near the end of the day, Arlene and the boys made their way to their old place on 13th Street. Arlene had left a pair of shoes there. As they approached the house, they saw a little outside in the snow, pawing at the door. Jory and Jafaris ran to him. Jory picked up Little and handed him to Jafaris, who pulled him in and kissed him.
"Put it down, dang!"
Arlene yelled. She jerked Jafaris' arm back, and Little fell to the ground. When Arlene was alone, she sometimes cried for Little. But she was teaching her sons to love small, to reject what they could not have. Arlene was protecting them and herself. What other self-defense was there for a single mother who could not consistently provide for her children? If a poor father failed his family, he could leave the way Larry did, try again at some point down the road. Poor mothers, most of them anyway, had to embrace this failure, to live with it. Arlene's children did not always have a home. They did not always have food. Arlene was not always able to offer them stability. Stability cost too much. She was not always able to protect them from dangerous streets. Those streets were her streets. Arlene sacrificed for her boys, fed them as best she could, clothed them with what she had. But when they wanted more than she could give, she had ways, some subtle, others not, of telling them they didn't deserve it. When Jory wanted something most teenagers want, new shoes or a hair product, she would tell him he was selfish or just bad. When Jafaris cried, Arlene sometimes yelled, "Damn you hard-headed! Dry your face up!" Or, "Stop it, Jafaris, before I beat your ass! I'm tired of your bitch ass!" Sometimes, when he was hungry, Arlene would say, "Don't be getting in the kitchen because I know you're not hungry." Or would tell him to stay out of the barren cupboards because he was getting too fat. You could only say, "I'm sorry, I can't," so many times before you began to feel worthless, edging closer to a breaking point. So you protected yourself, in a reflexive way, by finding ways to say, "No, I won't. I cannot help you. So I will find you unworthy of help." Ministers and church ladies, social workers and politicians, teachers and neighbors, police and parole officers throughout the black community would tell you that what you were doing was right, that what these young black boys and girls needed was a stern hand. Do not spare the rod. What began as survival carried forward in the name of culture. As they walked away from 13th Street and Little, and the detritus of their things still scattered in the snow, Jafaris opened his hand to reveal a pair of earrings. "Where'd you get these from, Jafaris?" Arlene asked. "Stole them from Crystal." "Oh, wow." A pause. Then, "That's not funny, and it's not nice, Jafaris. You hear what I'm saying?" Jafaris' face fell. He just wanted to do something sweet for his mama. Arlene knew this and was touched. She would return the earrings later, but for the moment, she put them on. Jafaris smiled. They had one more stop to make. As the sky grew inky blue and temperatures fell, Arlene met a white landlord in a flannel shirt and tool belt, fixing up a two-bedroom apartment with such haste and stress, Arlene wondered if the inspector was coming the next day. She filled out an application, and Jafaris used the bathroom. It was too late when he discovered the toilet didn't flush. Arlene thanked the landlord and, taking Jafaris by the hand, rushed out. A few minutes later, her phone rang. "That was very rude," the landlord was yelling. "And I don't like children like that." Arlene and her boys could stay in the shelter for 29 more days. 20. Nobody wants the North Side. The lodge sat on the corner of 7th and Vine Streets, near downtown. On most days, residents gathered near the entrance, talking, smoking, and running after their children. That was where Crystal had been spending most of her time since the final days of February. On Crystal's eviction court papers, Sharina had checked the box next to "The landlord desires the premises for the following reasons," writing in, "causing substantial disturbances with upper and lower tenants, with police involvement. Also, unauthorized subleasing to an evicted tenant." Crystal was confused by the whole process. Could Sharina call Arlene unauthorized when she knew about their arrangement from the start? She packed her things into two clear garbage bags and left without going to court, wrongly assuming that doing so would keep her name clean. Crystal hated the food at the lodge, and some of the maintenance men propositioned the residents for sex, offering fresh sheets, snacks, or extra shampoo. But she liked her room. It was warm, clean, and free. Said Crystal, "I ain't paying no $5.50 and feel like I'm getting nothing." Plus, she was on the hunt for a new friend, and the lodge was a great place to find one. It collected under a single roof dozens of people who had found themselves in especially desperate situations, who were all going through a thing, as shelter residents put it. People were attracted to Crystal. She was gregarious and funny, with an enduring habit of slapping her hands together and laughing at herself. She would saunter out the doors of the lodge, singing gospel, her hands raised in praise. Crystal had some suitors, but what she wanted most of all from her new friends, and what she had wanted from Arlene, was a mother figure. She found one in Vanetta. Vanetta Evans had been staying at the lodge since January. At 20, she was not much older than Crystal, but she'd grown up fast. Vanetta had her first child, Kendall Jr., when she was 16. Then a daughter, Tembi, the next year. And a third, the year after that, a boy named Bobo. You might say Vanetta was raised in the Robert Taylor homes, Chicago's infamous public housing towers. Or you might say that her mentally challenged mother, whom Vanetta and her siblings unaffectionately called Shortcake, raised her in almost every homeless shelter in Illinois and Wisconsin. Crystal liked the way Vanetta carried herself. She was always put together, with her hair pulled back tight in a small ponytail. She even wore her cell phone on a belt holder, like a landlord. Vanetta's dark brown skin matched Crystal's, and she had a smoky, lounge singer voice that she almost never raised at her kids. She could snap them in line by giving them the look. When Kendall Jr. acted up, Vanetta pretended to call Big Kendall, his father, on the phone. The boy knew she was faking, but would calm down anyway. When Bobo had seizures, she rushed him to the hospital. The two women began swapping cigarettes, each keeping mental note of the number of Newports given and received. Soon they upped the ante, taking incremental but expedited steps toward establishing a relationship of reciprocity. They exchanged snacks, then small bills, then meals purchased at fast food restaurants. Through passing references, they began learning about the other's resources. Vanetta received $673 a month from welfare and $380 in food stamps, as well as their character and temperament. Crystal and Vanetta began calling each other sister. After a week, they decided to look for housing together. Roommates inside the homeless shelter would become roommates outside of it. Crystal didn't think she needed to worry about Vanetta's upcoming sentencing hearing. "Prayer is a powerful thing," she said. Vanetta thought her chances of avoiding prison were decent, even without Jesus. It was her first offense. The trouble had started when Old Country Buffet slashed Vanetta's hours. Instead of working 5 days a week, she would now only work one. Her manager blamed the recession. After that, Vanetta couldn't pay her electricity bill. We Energies threatened disconnection unless she paid $705. There was no way she could pay that, and the rent. But she worried that Child Protective Services would take her kids away if her lights and gas were shut off. The thought of losing her children made Vanetta sick to her stomach. Then she fell behind in rent and received an eviction notice. She felt helpless and terrified. Her friend, who had also received the pink papers, felt the same way. One day, with Vanetta's boyfriend, the two women sat in a van and watched another pair of women walk into a Blockbuster carrying purses. Someone suggested robbing the women and splitting the money. Then all of a sudden, that's what they were doing. Vanetta's boyfriend unloaded his gun and handed it to her friend. The friend ran from the van and pointed the pistol at the women. Vanetta followed, collecting their purses. The cops picked them up a few hours later. In her confession, Vanetta had said, "I was desperate to pay my bills, and I was nervous and scared and did not want to see my kids in the dark or out on the street." When she turned 18, Vanetta had put her name on the list for public housing. Becoming a convicted felon meant that her chances of ever being approved were almost zero. At her plea hearing, the judge told Vanetta that she could be subject to a fine of up to $100,000, 40 years of imprisonment, or both. Vanetta tried not to think about that. After her hearing, she was fired and then evicted, which was when she took her kids to the lodge. Crystal and Vanetta agreed to look for an apartment exclusively on the Hispanic South Side. When they felt God smiling on them, they even looked in white neighborhoods. They refused to consider the North Side. "It would be nice to get away from these black motherfuckers," Crystal said. They began making daily bus trips to the South Side and calling on rent signs. Even in the age of online apartment listing sites, the humble rent sign remained a visible and effective beacon, especially in minority neighborhoods. Only 15% of black renters looking for housing relied on the internet. By not consulting print or online listings, Crystal and Vanetta constricted their options to what they could see with their own eyes, often from a foggy bus window. The new friends looked at a small two-bedroom unit, but turned down an application when they learned the landlord didn't allow smoking. They hung up when a landlord answered in Spanish.
"You want $650 for a two-bedroom? You out of your mind,"
Crystal told one landlord. After calling a dozen apartments, Vanetta suggested they try affordable rentals. You would know it from its tiny storefront office on National Avenue, one of the South Side's main motorways, but affordable rentals was a giant in Milwaukee's low-income rental market. The company owned over 300 rental units and managed almost 500 more.
"Don't get ghetto in there,"
Vanetta reminded Crystal as they walked toward the door. Inside, they put down a deposit, and the receptionist behind thick glass handed them a master key so they could inspect the units on their own. The places were small but clean, except for the one with diapers and tires in the backyard. The gem of the bunch was a two-bedroom apartment with a tub, renting for $445. Vanetta wanted a tub so her kids could take baths. The women rushed back and filled out an application. A paper, taped to the wall, announced affordable rentals screening criteria. "We reject applicants for the following reasons. 1. First-time tenants without a cosigner. 2. Any evictions within the last 3 years. 3. Felony drug or violent crime conviction within the last 7 years. 4. Misdemeanor drug or disorderly conduct crime charges within the last 3 years. 5. Non-verifiable income or insufficient income. 6. Non-verifiable rental history or any bad reference from a previous landlord." Crystal and Vanetta paid no mind to the sign. On the rental application, Vanetta listed her twin brother as a reference. Crystal listed her spiritual mom. As she waited to hear back from affordable rentals, Vanetta wondered if they needed to look at units priced over their $550 limit. But she didn't want to go higher, mainly because she didn't know if Crystal was able to hold onto her money. At the lodge, Vanetta had watched Crystal spend down her check on clothes, fast food, and even slot machines at the casino.
"Girl, I'm gonna punch you in the mouth,"
Vanetta would vent. A healthy chunk of Crystal's money also went into the offering basket the first Sunday of every month.
"I'm sowing seeds," Crystal said, as the women sat down at George Webb.
It was Crystal's treat. She had won $450 at Pottawatomie Casino the night before, using a $40 birthday present from her foster care agency to play the slots. The waitress brought Crystal the cup of hot water she requested. She slid her silverware in the cup to clean it.
"Remember how I explained to you last time? If you're a farmer and you plant your seeds for your corn and your vegetables and all that, and you water and take care of it, your crop's gonna come. That's how I look at it when I sow seeds in the church. I need something from God, so I sow a seed. I need a house. I need financial breakthrough. I need healing from stuff. I need to be made whole. That's how I'm gonna put it."
Vanetta held her chilled look.
"That's why I don't creep with your church, 'cause they don't have nothing to offer you, but they got a lot to say, and I don't like that. And then you go to them and tell them the situation that's going on, and it's like they don't care."
Crystal looked at her food.
"I don't know," she said. I'm just waiting to move."
She tried to change the subject.
"That cheesecake banging."
But Vanetta was not through.
"Don't ball up your face," she said. "Motherfuckers smile in your face when you tithe."
"Nuh-uh."
Crystal shook her head.
"You be throwing all that money in they basket. Don't say nuh-uh, 'cause I seen it when I went Sunday."
Vanetta knew how much Crystal's church meant to her. She had heard Crystal run on about Minister Barber and the bishops and the Holy Ghost and all that. She had watched Crystal take herself to church on Sundays, Tuesdays, Fridays, and sometimes Saturdays for special services. If the congregation at Mount Calvary Pentecostal wasn't Crystal's family, who was? But Crystal's church was Vanetta's biggest competition. Every seed Crystal sowed in the offering basket left Vanetta with less money for their budding household. Vanetta didn't know if what she'd said had penetrated until later that day, when she came upon Crystal crying into her phone and praying in tongues.
Ishanta, Ishanta.